Hello everybody, welcome to the COHK Anthropology Podcast. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Wyman Tang, a lecturer in the Department of Anthropology. Wyman's academic research has focused on the conditions of South Asian communities in Hong Kong. This began with his PhD dissertation project on drug use among Nepali youth. His current research is concerned with the South Asian sport of kabaddi, an interest that began shortly after he completed his PhD studies. Today we speak to Wyman about his life and experiences in anthropology, in particular, how his research interests have evolved and changed over time.
Hello, Wyman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Tong Yi.
Thanks so much for agreeing to speak with us. We are interested to know how you came to anthropology and basically your life in anthropology. So perhaps a good place to start is with your life story in anthropology. Can you take us back to how it all began?
Yeah, sure. So I studied anthropology from an undergraduate program. After graduation from the degree program, and then I got into MPhil and then a PhD. So I still remember my student ID starts with 98. That means 1998. So it's 23 years ago. And I studied anthropology in the same department, same university throughout the years. When I was in secondary school, in Hong Kong, we have to choose the major subjects in Form 3. So there are mainly two, that is science and arts. At that time, I chose science. And the reason is that most of my friends chose science. So it's not related to the subject itself. It's just because of my friends. And after I start to study science subjects, and yeah, I feel regret. That is... many of my friends, they really enjoy doing experiments. So the test tubes, Bunsen burners, and mix the chemicals. And for me, I'm not good at this. And always fail in doing experiments. But then I realized that, while my classmates, my friends, they are doing experiments, I love to see how they do experiments. And I love to talk to people. Then I start to find that is my interest. That is human, not the chemicals. Mm. Well, when I consider the major subject in a university, then I start to look for subjects which are related to human. And there is there are other stories that make me interested in anthropology. That is also related to my school, my secondary school, and also my summer work experience. For my secondary school, it is located in Stanley, the southern part of Hong Kong Island. In that school, there are many different sorts of people. Some live in Repulse Bay, live in very big apartments. Mm. And then I visit their home. And yeah, they have three foreign domestic workers at home. And then have a large dining room, sitting room. And hey, I was amazed by this. And then they would brought me to those country club places. And then I see, this is your lifestyle. And then at the same time in my school, there were some people who come from the in Southern District, like Hua Fu Chun, those public housing estates. Mm. And again, I visited their place. And then I saw another kind of a lifestyle. Even though we all live in Hong Kong, then I realized that there are interesting differences. And one more thing is during my summer work, it's Form 5 after the Weihao, the public exam. Mm. I worked in a printing company. The printing company is a small company. The father, the husband, is the boss. And then his wife did the admin work. And then his father is the driver delivering the goods. So the company is like this. And then I worked there as a laborer. So in the morning, I will try to help the printing work. So how to, yeah, I'm somehow good at counting the number of papers. And then also how to wrap the paper. And in the afternoon, we'll deliver the goods. This is my first work experience.
Right.
And at that time, it's summer. So it's as hot as these days. So yes. It's 36 degree Celsius. And then they use the old driver use the private car to deliver the goods, and he will never turn on the aircon, and he would always try to save the cost. So when have to go to the Kowloon side, and he use the cross harbor tunnel, and there is always traffic jam, and you can imagine what the car is like. It's a steamy hot.
Yes.
And you're sweating in the car. But again, he will never turn on the AC because he want to save the gas. And we always have to work very, very fast. So have to carry the heavy goods and then send to different companies. In front of him, I cannot walk. I always have to run with the goods. And when I get out of his eyesight, and then I'll start to walk. And but still, that he wants to save the time and save the money. And for me, every day in the afternoon, I feel that, it's like a battle. I have to beat the time and beat the money, because the old driver explained to me, this is their lifestyle. This is how they can survive.
Wow.
And at that time, every day, I just hope that the 31st of August will come soon. This is the end of the summer holiday. Then I can leave my job and I can start my school again.
But you lasted there for about 3 months. Is that right?
Well, two months.
You worked only over the summer.
Only the summer.
Yes.
At the same time, I start to think, for other factory workers, if they have to work like this every day, how can they make sense of their life? So for me, I only need to work like this for a summer, so only 2 months. But then for others, does it mean that they have to wait till 65 years old? And at that time, I beat the time and beat the, I try to finish my work early. And then I thought, that day I can go home early. But that's not the story. And then they say, today we finish early. Let's go back to the office to get more goods and then to do the delivery again. So it's endless. That means, if I work harder, that means I have to work more.
Yes.
So, I feel this system is very strange. But later on, I get a chance to talk to the boss and talk to the his wife, and then start, and then realize that in the printing factories in the industry is that competitive.
Right.
So I remember after maybe 3 to 5 years, and their company has to be closed down, because now most of the factories have shifted to mainland China already. But at that time, it's very competitive. So again, this experience always make me ask, what is happening in this society? So some people who live in the repulse bay, having free domestic workers at home, and then enjoying their it's afternoon time. Everybody is going to work, but then they are at the country club eating the sandwiches and then drinking the afternoon tea. And then for others, they are sweating and then in a private car sending goods. So how to make sense of all this? And that's why I want to know more about our society, cultures, and in Form 7. That is, there is open day in Chinese U. I try to visit different departments, which is in social science faculty. And I found that in psychology, they have too many numbers and experiments I know I cannot deal with. And then when I went to sociology, the same experience, a lot of statistics. So I know I cannot deal with it. And I visit anthropology. There are a lot of tests. There are a lot of stories. That time, I still remember in the department, they will show a lot of cultures of different places. And I found that, that's what I want to know. And that's how I start to study anthropology.
That's a fascinating story, Wyman. So in a sense, you actually discovered this before you started university, you discovered what you wanted to study while you were in high school.
Just having questions. Having the question marks in my mind. So at first, I love to observing people. And then I, at the same time, I want to know why there is differences, even though we live in the same society.
Can you tell us then, well, since then, it's 22 years is a very long time in a discipline.
Yeah.
So what have you discovered? And I mean, after you started, what did you begin to do research on? And maybe you can bring us to this point, how that research, those research questions have evolved. So you started by questioning the notion of inequality in society, right? These class differences, and your own personal experience of being a, I guess, a laborer in a factory and somewhat exploited and somewhat intensively exploited, right? Having to, if you work fast, they would make you do even more. So how have those questions evolved, and what kind of account do you have about the world? So take us slowly through that process, right? So it started with exploitation or inequality, and how have your research projects or research questions transformed over time?
At the time, we studied anthropology for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And in my second year, we took a course that is world ethnography. Yeah, I guess most anthropologists will know the wilder sentiments.
Yes.
And then it's just talking about the woman in a Bedouin society, and talking about how the woman in the society found their agency. At that time, in that course, we used the whole course to study this one book. So we study it very intensively, and for me, I'm very impressed by the ethnography. Of course, this is first the author, how she lived among them, and then how they because at that time, a woman in the Middle East, it's difficult to know their stories. And
now the author is Abu Lugad, is that correct?
Leila Abu Lugad.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because in the past, people will only talk about the man, but somehow she discovered the story of women, and also found out their agency, how they did the poetry, and then how they did the songs and to express themselves. So, throughout my 3 year study, I am always interested in learning about the social minorities and then their resilience, their agency. Mm. So this is about gender. Mm. After a 3 year of study, I just found that I haven't known enough. At that time, I did do a research paper. And there is another experience that is very impressive. That is, again, I was taking a course about Southeast Asian cultures and society. And the fieldwork that I did is go to a charismatic church in Hong Kong attended by the Filipinos. Mm. So when I attend that church, I also used to go to church and the evangelical churches in Hong Kong. And at that time, I was the first time to attend a charismatic church. I didn't know what it's really like, but in the prayer sessions, most of the attendants are crying aloud. Mm. And then I was so shocked. And what is happening? Why everyone is crying like this? Mm. And then afterwards, I talked to them. That is actually, I was introduced by one Filipino who brought me there. And then I talked to her. So why people were so emotional during the service? Mm. And she just told me that many of them miss home, and then also sometimes their work is really hard in Hong Kong. But then I asked, how did it improve your situation? How what is your hope in Hong Kong? And then she told me that she hoped that by praying at church, crying to Lord, and then God will help them. And she would also think that we are now unlucky, that maybe we met a not a good employer, but she hoped that yeah, maybe God is, maybe it is caused by their sins. If they pray to God sincerely and then cleanse their sin, maybe they will find a good, better employer, and then they can live their life happier, something like this. Mm. At that time, of course, I would try to follow the Marx way of thinking. Is it a kind of false consciousness? And then that's just trying to place hope on the religion and then to improve their life. But later on, I start to think, what are their alternatives for them if they don't try to think in this way? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that they know that this may not be the best alternative, but somehow at that moment, at that stage, this is the thing that they can do. That is to place their hope on religion. So they know what is really going on. Mm-hmm. And this book, and then Buddha sentiments, and then also that time going to a charismatic church attended by the Filipino domestic workers, and make you want to really do research on social minorities to get to know more. And I applied for MPhil, that's this research-based program. And at that time, my topic is about sexual minorities, that is gay Christians in Hong Kong, that Tomji Gitopto. And again, at that time, my idea is that, it's not really not easy to be a gay Christian because you are marginalized in many sense. You are marginalized by church, and then you are marginalized by the gay community. And so again, why they still try to keep this identity, or how they try to negotiate this identity. So that is my end view. And for my PhD, is something similar. That is about Nepalese drug users in Hong Kong. So another social minority that's facing difficulties in Hong Kong, and then have the drug use behaviors. So let me say a little bit more about my PhD study.
Yeah, yes. Wyman, you've continued without any kind of break in your studies. So you started from undergraduate, and you proceeded immediately after you graduated with your BA to do a MPhil. Is that right? And then, wow, so it's without any breaks.
I actually took a break in between MPhil and PhD. So at that time, I worked in a consultant company. That consultant company is quite interesting. Yes. They would go to factories in mainland China. This is the southern part of mainland China. And to provide welfare activities for their factory workers. So like after work, and they would try to provide some entertainment, and then provide some leisure activities for them. And we try to organize those activities. So maybe in some special days, the festivals, and then I will organize a festival event. And again, it's a very interesting experience to me that I've never been to factories in mainland China. I didn't know that there are such kind of work going on in the factories. So, but I think it's a good opportunity for me to see, to apply my anthropological training and knowledge in this kind of work, to see what those factory workers really need, really want, and then and then we provide the services.
Tell me, Wyman, you've had a whole career of examining, I realize, socially marginalized populations, beginning with your own experience, I guess, as a laborer, and also your experience of classmates with very diverse socioeconomic backgrounds. What has sustained this interest in the marginalized groups? Can you explain that?
Because the problems still there. So you see, many people have talked about this, why there is poverty, and then why there is marginalization. And you see there are people doing different kinds of work, but the problem persists. And that's why I want to know more. I want to find the answers.
So perhaps you can proceed to talk about your MPhil dissertation on sexual minorities, or gay Christians in Hong Kong. So indeed, how did they resolve this conundrum? How did they resolve this contradiction between being Christian on the one hand and gay on the other? What were your findings? And similarly, how do you resolve this tendency within the Filipino Christian community to, you know, how do you explain their commitment to, you know, a Christian ethic in their lives?
About the my MPhil study on gay Christians in Hong Kong, at that time, because I grew up in Hong Kong, I didn't see, I took it for granted. And then I start to think that Christianity, churches are all the same. It's evangelical churches, and then their mission is to share gospel, and then they have to follow the Bible very strictly. And so I have the same idea when I went to that gay church. And it's true that, because in Hong Kong, most of the churches are like this, the evangelical churches, and many members also think in this way. But there are actually some members, they would never see this as a kind of problem. So they would have a more liberal attitude towards the Bible. It's, you do not need to literally follow the Bible, and also for sex morals, and again, you don't need to follow the strict narrow interpretation of sex in the Bible, and you can have different styles. So, and then I start to realize there is a diversity at church, at the gay church. There are different kinds of gay Christians, but what I find is that there's not much room for those rather liberal gay Christians in that gay church. And then in that gay church, they would adopt a rather conservative attitudes. Like, for example, they would tell the church members that, many cultures in the gay world is not that good. Like, they would have multiple sex partners, and they would have casual sex, and this kind of things should not be done for gay Christians. So for me, I find it interesting. I thought that sexual minorities, and then you should be try to be more inclusive, and then try to embrace different kinds of values or lifestyles. And but somehow at the church, they would have a very strong force to maintain their conservative approach, Yeah, and when I did participant observation, and then actually for some so-called conservative members, on Sunday, they would go to church, and the nights before that, we were at the gay bar, and then we were hanging out. So you see the differences, but somehow they won't bring this experience back to church. So my research focused on this. That is how the gay church maintain its values, and at the same time, how different kinds of gay Christians respond to this. Some choose to leave, some chose to hide, and then some chose to really strictly follow what that gay church advises.
So it's really fraught with contradictions. Even though it's a church, they are accepting of gays on the one hand. On the other, they seem to be promoting a kind of monogamy their relationships, right?
So basically follow the literal Bible everything, except that the partner is a different person.
Yes. So you could say there's some level of tolerance. I mean, because to say a gay church itself could be an oxymoron, right? It's a contradiction in terms, the gay church. If you're literal, if you're literalist, when it comes to the Bible, then gay church is an oxymoron. It's a contradiction. So at least they allow for that contradiction.
Yep.
And then with that, within that contradiction, they stick to a strict biblical
interpretation. Yeah.
How interesting, Wyman. You wanted to say something about your work then with Nepalese drug users in Hong Kong. How easy was it to find out or to do research among them, given that I suppose drug use is for the most part illegal?
So it's back in 2003, something like that. It was the first time for me to visit Nepal. It's just for traveling. And after visiting that place, I found the Nepali culture is very interesting. And when I went back to Hong Kong, I try to, because I know that there are some Nepalese in Hong Kong, and then I try to look for them. And at that time, I was told by one friend that, oh, do you want to do voluntary service for Nepalese? You can go to a drug rehab center. And then I was surprised that, what? I want to know, meet Nepali friends, and then you told me to go to drug rehab center to do voluntary service. Then. Yeah, and then he said, yeah, now in one rehab center, they have some Nepali residents, a young group of people. Then I went there and then start to know, oh, there are some Nepali drug users in Hong Kong. So in the very first place, I tried to approach them through the drug rehab centers. Mm. And then try to get to know their stories, why they use drugs. But later on, because you know that for those who choose to go to drug rehab centers, and then or have been in drug rehab centers, their way of thinking may not be the same as those current drug users. Mm-hmm. So because I really want to know the whole phenomenon, so I cannot just stay in the drug rehab centers. So I try to look for those current drug users by going to their communities. And one of the strategies is going to, because many of them live on the streets. So I try to visit their home and then also stay in the park where they usually hang out. And there are some successful cases that I really can make some friends with some of them. But I still found that it's not that effective. So they would still wonder, who am I? Mm. And because of my Chinese face as a male, and many people misunderstood me as a undercop. So they thought that I'm trying to investigate them, and it's difficult to gain their trust. But there is one interesting case that is, I got some funding to do a survey on Nepali drug users in Hong Kong. And I would try to work with some NGOs to look for those drug users. And one of the NGOs is working at the methadone clinic. So I went to methadone clinic, and through their referral, I met some of the respondents for my surveys. And one of the respondents, after doing the survey, to fill out the questionnaires, she started to tell me her story, try to tell me more. So she was telling me that she had a boyfriend, and then her boyfriend is also a drug user and selling pirate CDs at Temple Street, and he has got arrested. So he's now in the in custody, and she said she used to dependent on him. So the income, the money, and now she lost him, and really don't know what to do. And at the same time, her boyfriend told her that actually, after he got arrested, you can try to look for his big brother. That means those triad members. Mm. And they would give you some money to help you the difficult time. Yeah. And so she told me that, yeah, I want to look for this big brother. Can you go with me? Mm. And then my response is, what? That's, I have never tried to contact, or I know nothing about triads, triad members. I have yeah, never contact them. But somehow she made such a request, and then I follow her, and then to walk around the temple streets, and then to look for this big brother. And in the end, it's like we start to search from 11 p.m. and then search till 3 a.m. and finally found him. And then when we met him, and then we explained the situation that her husband has got arrested by the police for selling the pirate CDs, and that big brother just told me that, yeah, the bad words, and then asked us to leave, don't give him trouble. So we got nothing. We searched for whole nights, and then we got nothing, just a few foul words. Yeah, and then my informant, my friend, and then felt very desperate. So yeah, she tried to ask more help from me, and later on I visit her home. She brought me to her home. She lived on a rooftop. She has warned me that she lived in a jungle. It's just not a very nice place. But I still want to see how it's like. And then when I really arrived her home, the rooftop home, and it's, yeah, I understand why is this a jungle. And there are animals, and many. Do you know what kind of animals?
Rats.
Close. It's just cockroaches.
Cockroaches.
And it's a huge number. And then it's just right next to her bed. She slept with those cockroaches.
Wow.
And then she told me that is her life. And and then this is also where she stayed with her boyfriend. Of course, I'm doing research. She knows that I'm a researcher. She doesn't mind sharing her story with me. And we try to make friends, seeing her situation, living in the jungle. So try to say, okay, you get the welfare money, right? The welfare money went to your boyfriend, but now your boyfriend got arrested, and you should ask the welfare department to transfer the money to you, not to your boyfriend. So I went with her to those office, and of course the officer won't be nice to her, and then we think that you caused so much trouble, and then you want to change the account, and but now at the same time also ask her, do you have a bank account? And if you don't, and then you need to come to the office every time, and every time the officer will give her a very bad attitude that gave her much trouble. Of course, it's just not a good experience. And then we start to think, okay, then try to open a bank account. And then we went to the bank. But again, in Hong Kong, if you want to have a bank account, you need to have a valid address, your home address. And a rooftop doesn't count. And then again, we try to help her to look for a proper place to live, have a valid address, and then he can open a bank account. Sorry for the long story, but
Wyman, what is the history of Nepali people in Hong Kong? So how did this particular person, was she born in Hong Kong, or did she come here by some means? What is the history of at least Nepali people in Hong Kong?
And most of them, they would say they are they have the Gorkha history. Gorkha is the British army stationed in most of the members are Nepalese, and then stationed in Hong Kong before 1997. That is the majority. But at the same time, there are some people who have no Gorkha background. So they would come to Hong Kong by other methods, like foreign domestic workers, and then some by fake marriage. This is for those Gorkha descendants. They have the Hong Kong ID, so they can sell their Hong Kong ID by having the fake marriage. So some would come to Hong Kong in this way. So some in their community, they would call those who work overseas, who have the Gorkha background, as the Lao Re. This is one of the way to call them. And then they would have the way to say fake Lao Re and the real Lao Re. So the Lao Re is the real Gorkha descendants, and then the fake one are those try to use other methods to come to Hong Kong and then to claim they are the real Lao Re.
In which case, thank you for that, Wyman. In which case, actually, they've had a long presence in Hong Kong. through their association with the British, when Hong Kong was a British colony, they came as Gurkhas, and it was really through that association that you could have then fake Lahore coming in. So I was thinking that their numbers have surely diminished, right? Since after 97, what's happened to the flow of these people? Has their population actually decreased or at least stayed the same since the handover?
Yeah, after the handover, then the Gorkha army was disbanded, and but somehow they were given the work visa in Hong Kong, so they continue to live in this city. At the same time, some Gorkha soldiers, they fight for their right of abode in Britain. So after some years, they finally got it. So some of them migrated to the UK. So now the official figures saying that there are around 25,000 Nepalese in Hong Kong. The number has been increasing, but it's not increasing in a even pace. In some years, you can see that the increase is slow because some of them have migrated to the UK. But generally, it is increasing. Yeah, this is some background information about the Gorkha, the Nepalese in Hong Kong. And so I have helped my informant to find a place to live. And I continue to make friends with her. And then every day she needs to go to the methadone clinic and to take the methadone. I'll wait for her downstairs. And the social worker who introduced her to me saw us. She was very unhappy and saying that, oh, I introduced this person to you just for doing the survey, for doing the questionnaire. How come you continue to meet her? So this is not what I was told. So the social worker talked to me and saying that I need to make complaints to your department, to your supervisor, and saying that you are not following the research ethics. And at the same time, my friend also saw that social worker. That informant told me that, do you know what the social worker told me? And they're saying that I have to cut the relationship with you, and saying that you are a dangerous person. So you are a man, so you may take advantage of me. And then also that you are a researcher, so you may write the bad story about me. Is that true? At that time, I will see her as my key informant. So I told you earlier that I did research in the drug rehab center, and then I carry out a few work in the park, in the place they stay. But it's a bit hard, fail to develop rapport with them. But finally, I can develop the good relationship with one key informant. But she told me like this. And at that time, she told me, we recall, and then she said that when she told me that, my face really turned pale. So because this is my PhD study, and then if I fail, then I will fail. So it's a very big worry. And then when my informant saw such a change, saw me change like this, and then said that, no, Wyman, don't worry. I will still be with you, supporting you. But in the past, I thought that you are from the government. You have a lot of resources, so you can help me a lot. But now I finally find that you are also the enemy of the social worker. So you are also not those powerful ones. You are just like us, being used by the social workers. So no worry, I can help you. So what kind of stories you want to write? What kind of people that you want to meet? I can introduce them to you. Then, for me, since that incident, my relationship with my key informant has changed. You can see that in the earlier phase, she always asked help from me, that help her to open a bank account, help her to find a place to live, and then help her to find work. But now, at that time, actually, there is another incident that is some male drug users really unhappy that I always go hang out with her. And then because she knows that she will tell a lot of stories to a Hong Kong Chinese.
Yes.
They will sing like that. And some male drug users would tell me that, don't come to Jordan, don't come to Yamate, I'll give you trouble. If you still try to meet that woman, I may even come to your office to give you trouble. Then at that time, again, I really don't know what is happening. I told this to my key informant, and then my key informant just said, no worry, I will protect you. Those male drug users, they are useless. They cannot even leave Jordan. How can they come to your office to give trouble to you? So you see how the relationship changed. And then I finally see that, earlier, she is more like a weak woman. So looking for help. And then now I see her agency or her wide social networks, that's actually how resourceful she is. And again, I start to know more about those people who, in the marginal positions, how they try to survive in their difficult life. And then how they make use of the different kind of social resources. Later on, she showed those resources to me, and where she can actually find food, where she can find money, and then how to avoid those people who would give trouble. And then I start to get to know more, and so this is one of the memorable experience in my field. That is how to see the field in a more holistic way. This is the different perspectives of my informants.
So after all these different cases of marginality that you've studied, you would agree, in fact you told me this, that the problem still persists. The problem of creating of marginalization still persists. So in your view, what is the problem? What is the source of the problem that there are so many marginal people, or there's such entrenched mechanisms of marginalization that keep, you know, that keep people at the bottom? In your view is the source of all this?
Yeah, I heard one story that is often shared among the Nepalese population in Hong Kong. The story is like this. That is when it was a handover. The British actually do not want to return Hong Kong to mainland China. Queen Elizabeth at that time decided, okay, you want me to return? I'll return, but I'll give you trouble. I'll leave you some cockroaches in this city. And then, do you know what are the cockroaches? And that is the Nepali. So this is the Nepali people who told me the story. And then, of course, I feel sad that how come you would describe yourself in such a way that you are trouble, you are the cockroaches. In the beginning, I also interpret in this way. And then, but later on, and I see the cockroaches actually is also very resilient.
They are indeed.
They have strong life. Yes. So I start to see the relations in a different ways. That is in Hong Kong society, ethnic relations are something new that not much discussed in the society. Only in the recent years, and then people start to talk more. Oh, we are a multicultural society, and now we have to understand the needs of our neighbors, ethnic neighbors. But in many occasions, what I find is that they always see them as a problem. They always see them as a service user. They need services. They have never try to understand in a holistic way, and then or never try to understand from their perspective what they really want or what they can really achieve, what can they can do. So if you try to treat them as weak, as surface users, and then they will always try to fit into that role for you. So if there are other kinds of ethnic relations, that is not hierarchical, seeing them as weak, seeing them as needy, Instead, I try to understand their seeing issues from their perspectives. I also try to understand the talents, the strengths that they have. Then it may change the ethnic relations. So at that time, my idea is that actually when they have the drug use behaviors, it's the very last stage of the marginalization. There are some more structural problems in the society that lead to this. So at that time, my supervisor was Professor Maria Tam, and she's also doing research on ethnic relations in Hong Kong. And yeah, she also realized this problem that we need to do something to change people's perceptions about ethnic minorities. So we start to do some projects that is emphasizing mutual empowerment, partnership, and sustainability. So it is not doing something once, but it's sustainable. And then it is a partner, not a hierarchical relationship. And at the same time, that is not the Chinese benefiting the African minorities. Instead, it's trying to benefit one another.
Thanks for that. I guess soon running out of time. So perhaps in closing, I'll ask one more question, one final question. And you might have already alluded to an answer to this. But what then do you see and the role of anthropology? What contribution do you think anthropology has then in resolving some of these maybe blind spots in Hong Kong society, you know? Because after all, what you've described is actually a long-standing issue. These ethnic minorities have been in Hong Kong for a long time, yet they don't seem to have been accepted, right?
Right.
How do you think anthropology can play a better role in integrating maybe these populations?
Yeah. So I think I still remember the first concept I learned in anthropology is cultural relativism. So I guess when you take a 101 in anthropology, you will learn it in the very first day. But and I find that it is still relevant now that in Hong Kong, throughout my school years, we didn't learn anything about ethnic minorities. They are invisible, they are insignificant, they are irrelevant, something like this. But then again, in anthropology, it's telling you that no, every person's voice is counted. And then we have to treat everyone the same. That and then also try to not to see them as more inferior or unimportant, but use the idea of cultural relativism to understand their situation or their communities. So I found this one is really helpful for me to promote the some positive ethnic relations in Hong Kong. So as you know, what I'm now trying to do is to do some positive ethnic relations project that is through sports and through South Asian game, which is called Kabaddi. And in this sport, I try to mingle the people together and then try to break the stereotype and also have a chance to let people of different ethnic backgrounds to make use of their talents and to meet one another. So this is what anthropology has taught me, and then also I think that this is not only for the sake of knowledge, but I think anthropology can also be practical, can be brought to the society, have a social engagement to bring some changes to the society as well.
Well, I said I'd ask you that final question, but this is before you brought up kabaddi. perhaps you can tell us how wide this project is, or how many people are involved in your kabaddi project now. What do you hope to do with kabaddi as a form of basically as a form of cultural knowledge, or as a bridge to build greater cultural understanding? Maybe just elaborate on that.
I think sports is an interesting means to share knowledge, share cultural knowledge, build communities, because sports is it involves emotions, it involves teamwork, and it involves physical. So if you don't share the same language, but somehow you know the same rules, and then you know the rules of games, and then you can play together. So I think this is a good channel to bring people together. And the other thing is that in Hong Kong, for the sports culture, the concept of community sports is not that strong. So for sports, it is either seen as a kind of leisure. So I want to have fun, then I'll do some exercise, or see it as a competitive sport that I want to achieve something by doing sports. So maybe I want to to be a representative of a district, a school, or even Hong Kong, and want to bring glories, and then I will try to play sports. But somehow we think that for sports, it's just not necessarily like this, only for the keen competition, but it is also can be a kind of a community that welcome any kind of people, put emphasis on the participation part instead of competition, and then build relationship in through the sports. I think this can also be done through sports.
Well, thank you, Wyman. I think with that, you've demonstrated basically the social function of, one of the social functions of sport, that is as a form of community building. Yeah. That's fascinating. Perhaps if we get the chance to talk again, you can elaborate on this project even more. Yeah. So thanks so much, Wyman. I thought that was great. Thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your invitation. And I hope that we can share more about sports, about anthropology. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. See you again, Wyman.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the COHK Anthropology Podcast. Please join us next time when we speak to Dr. Sharon Wong. Stay tuned.